We're talking with Chris Lambright about his new book, X Descending, the Paul Benowitz case. To recap, Paul Benowitz is this businessman, respectable guy, has a company that deals in scientific instruments. He starts seeing some strange things flying in and out of a secure military base. And when he tells the Air Force about it, they start a counterintelligence operation consisting of disinformation, sort of feeding him a bunch of crazy stuff, and he goes downhill from there. It takes a mental and physical toll on the guy. He ends up dying, and a whole bunch of other stuff gets filtered into the UFO community around the same time. Crazy stories, wild stories that the whole field has still been dealing with this many years later. We continue our conversation and open up the phone lines right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Chris, the skeptic in me wants to say this, is that, you know, we know from what you've described in the book that this guy Ray Stanford has a whole bunch of really amazing film footage of strange objects. We know that we suspect that there's a treasure trove of stuff that Mr. Benowitz had, you know, that has not been released. Do you believe that there's somewhere like a treasure trove of this stuff? I mean, the fact that it's not released, we have to just sort of take your word for it since you're the guy that saw it.
Well, I did call his son, Paul, in this case, son, before I finished the book, although I understood that, you know, that they just don't want to go into it, and I can't even blame him for that. I did finally write a letter. I expected no reply from her, but I did write a letter to his wife, which I hope she was able to read, asking if the films that he took, let alone all the other still pictures that he described, if those were kept either by her or his sons or somewhere, you know, somebody has them, to please lock them away somewhere safe. I mean, whether she or they would at some point give those over to somebody that they trust enough to look at them. I can only hope that would be the case. Paul had told me that the pictures on the film were much more intense and colorful than what I show in the book, because he sent me pictures off of his screen, so snapshots. So I have second, third generation, and I was still able to pull out that kind of detail. But I hope those films are somewhere. As far as Ray Stanford goes, that's the treasure trove, in my opinion. Not only because Ray is there to explain what they are, but I do understand that people feel like they have to take my word for it. Being skeptical, I'm skeptical. Ray and I go back and forth about things. He sends them, we cross-check each other. But I would stand by Ray as the treasure trove. Keep in mind, he's not a young man. I mean, he's not getting pictures every day. This is a guy who's been at this far longer than I have, far longer than many of us, and over that time has managed through either being he's just observant. I mean, the recent articles about his track discoveries in paleontology that came out in the Washington Post attest to the fact that he can see things where the experts said there was nothing. And now the experts are rewriting the books. So I would just stand by his visual acuity. But I have seen things that he has shown me that that's not our technology. I'm sorry. It's just not. He has things that I cannot at all account for that are just beyond me. And I want people to see it. Everybody should see it. Go see it.
And if you had to guess about the technology that was seen over Manzano by Mr. Benowitz and by his wife, by the way, she was another witness. If you had to guess about that technology, is that ours?
My guess at this point is it was allowed to be there. Now, maybe our guys were flying them. I can't see how we could have built those things and not have seen something of it somewhere else. We all know what, you know, that's 30, 40 years old. There were four of them there. One 36-foot, I think Paul estimated by his estimate, three 18-foot vehicles, clearly using some kind of technology, let alone the vehicles themselves, that's way beyond anything that's been seen, something that definitely qualifies as UFOs, if you want to call them that. We haven't seen anything of that anywhere else. And like you said, where are they now? I'm hard-pressed to believe that that's something that we, our guys, whether at Area 51 or somewhere else, just came up with on their own. And in fact, interesting that now to think of it, the first letter that I wrote to Mirabeau was to ask him about the Benowitz films. I simply asked him, as an expert. I said, if anyone, I referred him to some articles I had online at the time and some illustrations. I said, if anybody in this country, let alone some other one, might have been able to build these things, who did he think might have been able to do it?
And he wouldn't answer you, would he?
Never got a word. Never have heard a word of that, which he could have simply written back and said, I have no idea. And that would have been the end of it. So maybe that was telling me something. You know, I'm not trying to draw anything more from that. But the fact exists, in my opinion, that he saw what Ray had on film. And I think he definitely knows we have nothing like that kind of technology. And I don't know. I cannot answer yes or no absolutely. But I would say my bet at this point is that was not a technology that was generated and, you know, and designed and built absolutely right here on by our guys, so to speak. Or I think, well, in the last 30 years, we would have seen more of it somewhere else.
It just makes me think of the statements made by the late Ben Rich, the head of the Skunk Works, Lockheed Skunk Works, the guys who build all the amazing stuff that's tested out at Area 51, who said before he died, we already had the technology to take E.T. home. He wasn't very specific about what he meant by that. Chris, we're going to go to the phone line and see what's on the minds of our listeners. East of the Rockies, Rodney in New Jersey. Good morning, Rodney.
Hi, how are you doing?
Okay.
Mr. Knapp, I think you're the greatest. I think you blew the government right off its heels with the thing about Area 51.
Well, I didn't make many fans, that's for sure.
I was speaking to George Knapp a couple of weeks ago, and I never got a chance to finish my statement because he was running late and the show was almost over. But I wanted to ask your guest a question. I saw something in Pennsylvania maybe 25 years ago, maybe a little bit longer than that. But this thing, this craft, it is metallic. It's a bluish metallic. It was not even 150 feet away from me. And what it was enveloped in was kind of like something that you would see underneath a microscope. And I'm not...
What do you mean, like an amoeba?
Yeah, something like that. It was surrounded like something like that. And I don't know whether it was doing this to the air or whether it was connected to it or whether it was some kind of field around it or force field. I don't know what it was, but it wasn't symmetrical. It wasn't even. It was just like something that you would see underneath a microscope, and the craft was inside of it. And I don't know whether it was using that to maneuver or using that to fly or whatever it was doing.
Chris, does this sound like a plasma around the craft or something?
He brings up something that I began to kind of formulate how to answer this. And, of course, once again, this is just conjecture. But there is a question that has come up repeatedly in many of the things that that I talked about with Ray that has to do with strange optical effects that may be somehow due to whatever kind of propulsion or forces going on around these things. If you will note, in the illustration on the cover of my book and the ones inside about Ray's pictures, that if, I had to revise these before I released the book because I'd always imagined the thing is circular. But I had to revise the fact that there's some indication that the thing looks multi-sided. I mean, I would have thought, wait a minute, is this thing octagonal? Is it, you know, five-sided, six-sided? But I can't guarantee, and Ray and I have discussed it, that it may be that that is simply an optical effect. Something is distorting the area around the vehicle. And to a layman, somebody looking at it from a distance, especially at night, if it was bright enough that you couldn't really see the vehicle inside, but perhaps what this gentleman is describing is something along that line, that a plasma field of some sort around it. I've been working on some animations. I mean, I'm hoping at some point to come up with, perhaps to get a film or something started about Paul Benowitz. But in looking at the images, there are some very unusual kinds of effects going on in the, especially in the yellowish orange area around the top of this vehicle, that does indicate to me that there's some unusual field effects that go on and produce much of the glow, and that may be a plasma of some sort. But what the gentleman is describing may have been simply been a very good observation of some unusual distortions, because he said it was not symmetrical, that perhaps some of the distortions in the field around this, the plasma or whatnot, give the impression that it's surrounded by something. That's obviously conjecture until we get our hands on one. You know, it'll be hard to say. But he brings up a point that I've seen in other images as well, that sometimes it's not really clear what the vehicle itself actually looks like. And there are other pictures out there that people know of, very famous ones, that you look at it and you think it's spherical. But suddenly you begin to look and see corners or see straight edges here and there. And it may be that that's an effect of some sort, some optical distortion due to some of the field around it or something. But that sounds like a very intriguing description. I mean, and he may have actually seen something very telling there.
Yeah, Rodney, we appreciate that call. And just to let you know that there are a lot of people around the world who've described things in the sky that look like these giant floating amoebas. So you're not the only one there. I'd also say to you, Chris, not to beat a dead horse with Lazar and Area 51, but he had claimed to the craft that he saw could basically, because it could, gravity was generated, it could distort and bend light. You could be standing under one of these craft and not be able to see it. At least that's what he had described. And
there are many things that I would not have thought I would consider some time ago that I've come way around realizing. And part of it is, boy, you don't really know what you know. You can only kind of listen to what people say and go by what you see.
Yep.
But you're correct. I do think I've seen evidence of very strange distortions in what looks to be shapes that may be due to some of these kind of field effects.
West of the Rockies, Jeff in Culver City. How you doing, Jeff?
Hi, George and Mr. Lambright. Yes, it's tragic to see how Mr. Benowitz was practically driven insane by what he discovered. Seems like the certain government agencies had a habit of driving people crazy or saying they were crazy when they got too close or too inquisitive about certain things. But my question, Mr. Lambright, is this. Do you think that all of these modern technologies or technical advances we have now, 30 years later, like the drone and the internet and the space station, are a partial result of the UFO and alien technologies that were discovered and hidden from us and lied to about, that the government is just letting us know about these things now in incremental piecemeal steps? And I'll take your answer off the air.
Good question, Jeff. Thanks.
Ooh, boy, yeah.
it's fun to chew on this stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, and unfortunately, I've tried to even explain to some of my own friends that a lot of this is like climbing a rock face. You need to make sure you've got a solid foothold before you can be sure that you're moving upwards. So the idea, which I think Phil Corso's book kind of played up to some of this, that some of our existing technologies may have come from something we found somewhere else. How do you prove that? I mean, how can you? I mean, unless somebody, it's like who shot JFK and was there a conspiracy? I mean, unless you have somebody with a smoking gun or somebody definitively points to something or can show you something, I don't know. I mean, part of my feeling today is, pick your battles. Find what's the most effective evidence you can work towards to make the case, and perhaps all of these other answers will become known.
You make a pretty good, you're being modest, you make a pretty good case in your book for an example of this is that Ray Stanford shows you a video or a film of a UFO that flies in a very distinct and strange way. A scientist goes and sees that film and then subsequently goes to work on building exactly something exactly like it.
Yeah, and that's, you said it. I mean, and that's what should happen all the time. But as this gentleman even brought up, it's fear of ridicule. I mean, people, it has become so systemic that, I mean, I was talking to Ray earlier today and saying, you don't have scientists who have to worry about operations to make them, to ridicule them or skeptics out here trying to debunk them or fake things about science because it defeats the whole point of science. But here people ask legitimate questions about things that they've seen. My parents have seen things. I mean, people that I would trust implicitly. And for some reason, it's made to the point that even Mirabeau does not want to go into it. I mean, he told me in a phone conversation that if he ever is in an interview and the interviewer brings up the subject of UFOs, he's out of there. Now, whatever reason that is, that's a shame.
Well, it's ridiculous is what it is.
It is.
It's flat out ridiculous.
You should be able to say something about it. But the fear of ridicule, of course, we've all lived through that growing up, peer pressure and everything else. But it's a shame that it just keeps, and here's the point. It keeps people from speaking publicly about it or too publicly. But as in the case of Ray, there are plenty of people that I know of who have been to see what he's got. And in fact, I think he wouldn't mind me saying there will be a very substantial paper coming out within a couple of months. I'm not at liberty to say more than that. But the fact is that science, and there are people in science who have seen what he's got, just like the people in paleontology who finally went to his house to see what he had, and they knew. The minute they went there, it's, you know, end of story, so to speak. But yeah, I mean, it's just the fear of people, and rightfully so. After Ray and I had done an earlier interview, and, you know, you get grilled and raked over the coals for just not throwing it up on YouTube, as though YouTube is somehow the court of public opinion.
Yeah, the great arbiter or something.
I mean, and what happens on YouTube is people take pot shots for kicks or for fun, and unfortunately, Ray's correct that most scientists are not going to touch something that's been in that venue. They don't want to get into it. So the way he has handled it, and, you know, and rightfully so, he's been grilled himself over the years, so he is very defensive about it, and I have to say that I understand his point, although I encourage him all the time. You know, Ray, at some point you've got to put it out there, and he is, and he will, but he has never faulted to show it to anyone who shows up. I mean, he may not want it to get out of his hands too loose, but if you go see, you'll know, and I'm not the only one who's seen it. Plenty of other people have. Mirabeau has. Other scientists have. He'll name them. He can, but it's out there. It's just a shame that people are afraid to talk about it, because it's just, and maybe, let's face it, it's effective. The minute they feed Paul Benowitz a story and he begins to say something, and people just drop it. You know, they go on to something else. So,
well, I've said it before. I think the people who are in that line of work of discrediting this stuff are a lot better at their job than are the people like us who are trying to get to the bottom of what's really going on. I mean, that's just a fact. And the ridicule factor has worked. Mainstream scientists won't touch it, most of them. I've said it before that, you know, the job of science is to investigate the unexplained, not to explain the uninvestigated. But when it comes to things like UFOs, that is just simply not the way it works.
Yeah, I mean, I thought a lot about it, but then I decided, you know, I wrote the chapter on knowledge versus belief, in part because I had put out some feelers years back to see if even people who have an interest in the UFO phenomena would respond and pick up on, you know, on little clues and ask questions. Well, hey, what does this mean? What is that? But I'm of the opinion, I have a paper I wrote that was refused to be published by one of the UFO magazines out here, on why I think ufology as it is will fail. And a lot of it is simply that people are accustomed to there not being any good evidence, and you now live with this expectation, well, it's not going to happen today, and they just, you know, it's like magazines, you switch, next month something else comes out, you know, flip channels on the TV. People forget that they're no longer looking for the evidence, because they don't expect it to ever show up, and their mind kind of goes into a state of just numbness. They skim by, because I had mentioned some things about Ray's film, and as I mentioned with the article that I talked to the gentleman who worked at Popular Mechanics about, when I sent it to him, what got me was, never was there a question about, what evidence do you have to support this? Where did you get the story? What can you show me to back it up? It was just not interested. And I would have thought anybody would ask, wait a minute, can you back this up? You know, where's the evidence for this? So I hate to say it, and I don't know if that's just the way this is being handled, and you're right, you've done such a great job that people are just afraid to really look like they're taking it seriously. It's easier to laugh it off. It's easier to just turn away. But everybody is interested. I mean, I've never met anyone who was not interested, except maybe someone like Phil Klass. Well, I think he may have had his own agenda, or maybe it was.
Well, I don't think there's any question about that. Chris Lambright is the author of this new book, X Descending. It's an email book right now. Maybe it'll become a paperback or a hardcover. We'll ask him about that when we come back. We'll get back to our conversation with Chris Lambright and get to as many of your calls as we can right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Back to the phones, Val in Covina, California on the Wild Card Line. Val, thanks for holding. What's your question?
Well, not so much a question, George. One thing, a very outstanding presentation by Mr. Lambright, if I may say. I used to be in the Air Force Security Police. It's now known as the Security Forces. And I was stationed at Ellsworth Air Force Base in the early 1970s, where there were noted incidents that had taken place. I've been in contact with a number of other former airmen who were there. And one of the things that becomes prominent, and it seems that you've already discussed this, is that unfortunately, if the Air Force Command already has an agenda on this issue, and the stated mission of the OSI is to investigate and determine facts and let the chips fall where they may, somebody's not telling the truth. This is where I see them coming from. It pains me to say this. I'm very proud of my military service. I loved the Air Force, actually, when I was in it. But there are incidents, I don't know if you have time for me to describe them, but some of them are unbelievable. I had been on the show before when you had a former Michigan State Police Sergeant, Ingrid Dean, discussing her book on these incidents that have taken place. And interestingly, they always seem to take place at nuclear facilities. Now, if you are another intelligent entity from out of this world, and if you have observations and concerns about this planet, would it not make reasonable sense that you would want to know what kind of powers or abilities we have?
Absolutely. And, the incidents over nuclear bases have been reported for a lot of years, not only in this country, but in other countries. Chris, a reaction to comments?
Now, the gentleman's point's well taken. In fact, Robert Hastings has written probably the premier book on UFOs and nukes, and I've had several conversations with him since coming out with this book about the fact that this occurred right there at Kirtland. And, of course, it was interesting to me, too, that the person who was, if I have my exact dates correct, the person who sat in, the General William Brookshire, who sat in on the meeting with Paul Benowitz at Kirtland, 5 years almost to the month exactly, had been up, was in charge of the Malmstrom Air Force Base at the time that there were all the overflights at their Malmstrom. I thought that was a highly unusual coincidence. The same guy who was in charge at Malmstrom and knew about those would end up being the person sitting in on the meeting with Paul Benowitz. The fact of the matter that these things are seen around nuclear facilities leaves you to wonder, are they looking out for us? Are they checking on what we've got? Is there some other reason that they're there? Are they making sure we're not going to blow ourselves up? I mean, I'd be speculating on any of these possibilities. But
right. Val, did you say that you saw this stuff yourself, or you just heard about it from others? Is Val there?
Hello?
I think Val's gone. Yeah, did you say that you saw this stuff yourself, or you just heard about it from other folks at Ellsworth?
I was a supervisor of two patrolmen, security policemen, who basically maintained security through observation of the various missile sites. They had a strange occurrence, which I can only describe. They saw nothing, heard nothing, and experienced nothing more than an obvious, undetermined light that was examining the launch facility, or I should say the launch site, where the actual ICBM comes out. Now, a recent thing that's come to my attention, because obviously Costos has a very large listenership, another airman contacted me about something I had known about during orientation training, which is several weeks before they let you get anywhere near nuclear equipment, talks about there's a large hatch which gives access to the missiles for technicians to work on it. And I remember being just going through an entire lecture about responsibility and security, et cetera. The trouble is that there's a number of vetting process before this enormous, by the way, it weighs in the tons, because it has to be lifted hydraulically. This hatch was found open by security personnel. They never really disciplined anybody. According to this one airman, who I'm going to get him in touch with, Robert Hastings, I don't think I should say his name over the air without his permission, but they were all dressed down over the issue, but nobody was actually charged with the responsibility. You see, there's at least a dozen people who would be involved in knowing whether the hatch is open or closed and properly secured. But yet we got lectured about it because it's obvious in the Air Force's mind, anything they can't explain that they don't want becoming public knowledge, they can basically browbeat junior enlisted personnel and officers who are interested in their career to keep their mouth shut, and let's keep it on a, shall we say, pardon me the pun, but an earthly level. Now, the incident that my airmen experienced wasn't so much that they didn't see anything other than this enormous light. It was, for me, when they came back to the launch control facility, it was the expression on their faces and what they described and the way they felt. You see, they're trained soldiers, basically. They can address an assailant. They know how to deal with trespassers. But something that's completely out of their control, they have no idea what to do. Now, this other technician that I have spoken to said there is no way that that hatch, as enormous as it is, I would love to show you a picture of what it looks like, nobody would leave it open without somebody knowing about it before they left the facility. They have to be in radio contract with base command before they even leave the facility. So how did this happen? Now, again, I'm not talking about ETs. I'm not talking about seeing UFOs. But there are unexplained incidents that the Air Force does not want to discuss openly with anyone.
Val, thank you much for the call. That's some interesting stuff. Any other comment on that, Chris?
Well, you know, there's the wide-eyed look. You know, it's one of those curious things that at times people see things and can't explain. I've heard that many times. You know, one guy turns to the other guy and his eyes are as big as saucers because he can't comprehend what he's seen. But I've also heard and read some of the strangest cases of things happening and people seem to just act like they've zoned out. I mean, if for some reason, as though they don't react at all, as though it was an everyday occurrence. And I don't know how to explain some of this stuff either, but his point's well taken. If the door is open and the Air Force dresses down all the men, but nobody's disciplined, you know, that tells you something right there. For something of that significance to go on and nobody gets outed, so to speak, tells you that there's more going on, or the Air Force is well aware of more than they're letting on. And I can't fault them. I mean, I'm not, you know, Ernest Edwards, the Air Force people that I spoke with, and I dare say Richard Doty, you know, I doubt they would be in the positions they were in unless they were good soldiers, so to speak, you know, good men. I mean, I don't have any real disrespect for Ernest Edwards or any of these guys at all, but you don't do that to the people that, I mean, we're all in this together, so to speak. And I take exception to comments that Richard Doty's made on the trailer for Mirage Men, commenting about Paul, saying, well, you know, Paul was a patriot. He flew his flag, and people like that are easy to fool, to tell them things. And I feel like, wait a minute, what are you saying to the patriots, and let alone the civilians out here, but that you just think, okay, well, if he's a patriot, or we can use these things to mislead people? That leaves a really bad impression of what FOSI, if no one else, might be willing to do to the average person out here. Especially.
Well, yeah, I mean, spy on people, feed them disinformation, drive them crazy, get into their house, take photos of it without their permission. We're talking about a military agency conducting an operation against civilians because they saw something that they're not allowed to see. That's some spooky and scary stuff and raises a lot of implications that are uncomfortable for us.
Yeah, there were a couple of comments along this line of things of breaking into Paul's house and sneaking people in, and Robert Fugit, people that received, you know, some very highest level civilian awards practically, and claims that they're being snuck into Paul Benowitz's home to look at his equipment. And I, you know, I think, why aren't people calling their congressmen and saying, why aren't these people being called to account? I mean, it's not just Doty. I mean, I'm sure Doty is like many of the other people down below that have to follow orders or else. Like,
yep,
this gentleman suggested that you follow orders or else. What about the people up above them that have never been named? Why aren't those people being called before Congress to account? I mean, these are names. One of my points is, here is a case where people are alive and the names are there that you could go to and bring these people in to ask them to explain what was going on. But nobody's doing that. I mean, the public should, I mean, disclosure project, that sort of thing, notwithstanding, public should go to their congressman and say, look, here are some people who have admitted to this. Doty's admitted to this kind of thing. People have been named. Who's going to, you know, to be called to account for this?
Well, I think if the Air Force had done this on any other subject, if you take the three letters UFO out of this, you might be able to get somebody from Congress interested in pursuing it. But with the UFO thing in there, no one wants to touch it. We're going to go to Lee in Iowa on a wild card line. Hi, Lee.
Good morning, gentlemen, and George, congratulations on your recent award.
Thank you.
I want to take issue with the fact that the guest thinks that the Air Force probably couldn't keep a secret. They just landed a space plane that was up for a year that I didn't know anything about, and I don't know how many other people did. But I don't know if we can even speculate on what kind of technology they may be working on or have today. But my question is, are we now, because of the disinformation, supposed to scrap everything we thought we knew about UFOs?
Oh, boy. That is an excellent question. No, I don't think we have to. I have some mantras that I go by, and one of them is, and of course I'm putting myself on the same scale, that if all you know is something somebody else told you, you don't really know anything. So it's not so much a matter of just throwing everything out, But as I've said before, if it matters, find out. Pick up a phone and call. Go find out for yourself, or at least weigh the evidence and consider, you know, all the things. I mean, we have intelligence services who contend every day with other services that are trying to undermine them. Counterintelligence goes both ways, and you still have to be effective. You have to find, you know, what you're doing. But I think that's probably the best term to use is effectiveness. Find something that is going to get you somewhere down the road. Just doing things the same way they've been done for 50 years, and, you know, what's the definition of insanity, doing it the same way you've always done it, expecting a different result. I think things need to change. Something has to come up. But no, I don't think that we need to throw everything out, because there are plenty of instances of reports that are credible. I mean, you know, I get to see things every day that come through, even sad to say, but some things that appear on YouTube that you look at and you think, that's something unusual. That's somebody who really got something or who saw something, but it's just hard to know. And the average person, much of this is drowned in the muck of all the other nonsense that's out there. So it's very difficult at times to recognize, you know, what's something real from what might not be. It all comes down to who you trust. But you're right. Don't throw it all out. There is a lot of disinformation, but I, you know, with communication, what it is today, with the internet, with accessibility of things being out there, I don't think it can last too much longer. I mean, who owns what? You know, what the Air Force knows may be one thing, but I think the reality of the phenomenon itself, as far as the, you know, what I've written about and described in the book, you know, it's. I don't think it can last forever. I mean, at some point there has to be a point at which it's, you know, it's out there.
By the way, Lee, I think the point was not being made by Chris that the military can't keep secrets. It's just that he was saying that this technology that was test flown 30 years ago, where is it? Meaning if it's operational, if it worked, it should be used somewhere. I think that the military is perfectly capable of keeping secrets, that they do keep some very big secrets. So the assumption that everything leaks out is probably wrong. As for the example of the space plane, it's called the X-37B, and we have talked about it on this show several times. I've done some news stories about it here in Las Vegas. It's been reported all over the world that thing's been up there. However, we don't know what its job is. We don't know what its mission is, and the Air Force isn't saying what it's been doing for the past year. So I think it's probably a good example of how secrets can be kept. Try to get one more call in. Sorrell in Virginia, good morning.
Hi,
hello?
George, hi, Chris.
Hi.
I understand that this is a question that does get asked a couple of times, you know, for Coast, but I'm wondering what the guest opinion is on why is the government not just exposing disclosure? What is it that is so important that we can't know about aliens and crafts? We have millions of people all over the world who see them. Again, you just like you said, you can view them on YouTube and on the internet. So why is there still a need to keep it hidden from us?
Well, good question, and we'll let Chris answer that to end the program. What do you think?
Well, I wondered, much like in the case of the Paul Benowitz case, it may not simply have been that somebody saw a UFO or somebody saw something altogether different. It's who's going to be called to account for it. In this case, it was over the government's backyard. There are plenty of good cases out there of people seeing things. And perhaps, like I was trying to describe earlier, I think there is an end game at some point where it will just not be possible to, you know, to keep it back. But it may also be that there's some acclimation going on rather than having everything out overnight. Eventually, you know, there was a famous story, Childhood's End, that had something along the same line. You know, you just let it be out there enough that people become accustomed to it. And if suddenly today something landed on the White House lawn, probably wouldn't be that big of a shock, not like it might have been 50 years ago, because so much of the generations have grown up accustomed to it. But at the same time, you know, governments are there to, and everybody's got a budget to watch out for. So if somebody could get their hands on some technology, whether it was the Navy or the Air Force, you know, you always hear that there's some competition in between the services, that each of them may be going for what they, you know, the Air Force's job is to protect us and to have better technology than the other guy. So maybe if they found out something, they're trying to hold on to it as long as they can, even though they may realize that you don't know how much everybody else knows. But the fact that we're talking about this right now, and many of the things that I've seen that Reyes got, the fact that Paul Benowitz got it on film, that I don't think if you look at the pictures that he got or the film that he got or that Ray has, you will know. I mean, you look at these and you will know this is, yeah, there is a technology out there. And that, I think, is one of the final points I was trying to make in the book, that wherever it comes from, there's a technology out there we should all be in on and have some benefit, you know, have the benefits of.
But as you make the point, too, as we become more advanced, as the things we build, the drones or whatever, become more advanced, the line between them and what may be considered a legitimate UFO blurs even further, you know? Yeah. And I think it's no accident that we've had so many numerous sightings of UFO-shaped craft on flatbed trucks going through major cities or down major highways. There was one last week in Washington, D.C., to allow everybody to see it, and it looks like a UFO, and it causes a big stir, and it's almost like the government saying, see, we've got these craft that look just like UFOs, but we're not going to talk about it.
Yeah, and I would do it. I mean, it would be a brilliant maneuver, you know? I mean, you would understand. So you're right. It is very difficult, and that was one of the first reasons that one of the ways that I found out about Mirabeau was following the old Skunk Works Digest.
Hey, very quickly, Chris, are you going to do, the book is on e-book now. Are you going to publish it?
Thanks for asking. Yes, I am. And initially, that was the, you know, I was like everyone else, that was the way I was going. The problem has been, and it was up to this point at least, maybe this program will make a difference, that getting it printed in color, because to me, the color images, you have to see them in color, the color matters, was very cost prohibitive, the kind of the economy of scale, doing it on a small basis. And I talked to some agents, and unfortunately, the publishing industry has been going through some real turmoil as well.
Oh, yeah.
Many of the publishers only want to print something that they're going to sell thousands and thousands of copies of, or at least once they know it's popular. But yes, I mean, I've got some plans in the works already here. I'm waiting to see how sales are going.
Good.
And when they build up, I'll do that. But if a publisher hears about it and is interested, I'll be glad to talk to them.
I'll let you know. Chris Lambright, thanks for joining us. It was an enjoyable conversation. The book is called X Descending. You can find it online right now and maybe in bookstores later. Interesting read. I would like to say thanks to Nathan Staton, Gina Salvati, Webmaster Lex, and Dan Galante there at Coast to Coast for helping me put this together. And next Sunday, you'll recall the show we did earlier this year about mysterious disappearances in national parks. David Politis comes back to talk about the East Coast cases that we never had a chance to discuss. It was one of the biggest reactions to any guest I've ever had. So I hope you can tune in then. Good night, everyone.